West tumbled backward onto the grass. His left eye immediately began to swell. Tony jumped on top of him, pinning West's arms to the ground with his knees. Once he'd locked West's arms down, Tony unloaded blows, striking his younger brother's chest, ribs, and face with wild abandon. West was trying hard to wriggle free, but his stronger and tougher older brother was getting the best of him. Mary heard the commotion and ran outside. She rushed over to the boys and tried to pull Tony off West, screaming for an explanation. After a brief struggle, West wrestled free and jumped back from his incensed brother. "What the hell is going on here?" Mary screamed. "West is out here hustling. I told him to leave us alone, but he won't listen," Tony yelled back. "No, he isn't. He's making the money DJing," Mary said. Hearing this, Tony pulled back his anger at Wes and turned it on his mother. "Are you serious? You really believe that? Are you blind?" Mary hesitated. Her voice was less assured when she responded. "Well, that's what he told me, and I believe him," she said. Her eyes turned to Wes. He stood about 10 feet away from them, head tilted back, trying to stop the bleeding from his nose. He suddenly jerked his head down to spit out the blood pooling in his mouth. Mary knew her younger son was no innocent. In addition to the knife fight when he was younger, Wes had been arrested a few years back after being caught stealing a car. But the sight of Tony punching Wes in the face infuriated her. Maybe it was because Wes was younger than Tony, and Mary knew well how violent Tony could be. Or maybe it was because she wanted so much for Tony to be wrong. She knew what her older son was into, but didn't think there was anything she could do for him now. She hoped that Wes would be different. Wes was completely taken aback by his brother's anger. Tony had tried to keep Wes in school and away from drugs for as long as Wes could remember. But Tony was still deep in the game himself. Wes didn't think Tony was a hypocrite exactly. He knew why his brother felt obliged to warn him off. But it was clear that Tony himself didn't have any better ideas, or he would have made those moves himself. And the truth was, Wes now had more money in his pocket than he ever had before, which kept him outfitted in new clothes, including a $200 cross-color set, now covered with grass stains and dirt. Tony looked over at Wes, his clothes, his crisp green footwear, the laces gleaming white even after their tumble through the grass. They were a long way from the days of youthful innocence, catching lightning bugs in jars, playing freeze tag on the Cherry Hill streets, and going to the Ocean City beach on summer days with their mother. The days of using shopping carts as a go-kart, pushing it to the top of the hill and letting gravity pull them down to the bottom were over. He realized he was staring at a mirror image of himself. "You know what, dude?" he said. "I'm good." Tony was exhausted. Tired from the beating he just gave Wes, tired from repeating himself. "If you won't listen, that's on you. You have potential to do so much more, go so much further. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right?" Tony leaned over to pick up his hat. It had fallen to the ground during their fight. He spun it around and placed it backward on his head. He walked off the lawn and into the street. Mary called out to him and asked where he was going. Tony yelled back over his shoulder, "Home," and kept walking down the block. He didn't look back again. That was the last time Tony ever tried to talk to Wes about the drug game. Mary raced over to Wes and examined his nose. The bleeding had slowed. "I am so sorry, Wes. That's just how Tony gets sometimes," she said. Wes looked back at her, but said nothing. They walked together into the house, where Mary wet a rag and started to clean up the scrapes and bruises Tony had left on his brother's face and body. The wet rag felt good over the open cuts on Wes's face. The deeper bruise, however, Mary could do nothing about. Wes knew he was disappointing his brother, which hurt much more than any beating he'd just taken. Wes was so confused. He loved and respected his brother. Tony was the closest thing Wes had to a role model. But the more he tried to be like his brother, the more his brother rejected him. The more he copied him, the more Tony pushed back. Wes wanted to be just like Tony. Tony wanted Wes to be nothing like him. Tony's outburst did accomplish one thing, though. It motivated Mary to dig a little deeper into Wes's new income flow. The next day, after Wes went off to school, Mary began searching through his drawers. She hoped that he was not involved in drugs. Please let it be DJ and money. Please let it be DJ and money. She prayed. She lifted his mattress and found a few extra shoeboxes under his bed. She placed them on the mattress. They were light, so she knew they didn't hold sneakers, but something was rattling around in them. As she reached for the top of one of the boxes, she pulled her hand back. She whispered to herself, "Don't ask a question unless you're ready to hear the answer." She reached again for the first Nike box and opened it. Inside were pills, marijuana, half an ounce of powder cocaine, and half a dozen vials of Ready Rock, or crack cocaine. She felt like she'd just been punched in the stomach. She sat down on the bed, unsure of what to think. She wasn't only upset about the drugs, she was upset about the lying. She didn't even bother looking in the second box. She already knew all she needed to know. Both of her sons were drug dealers. She sat paralyzed on the bed for 15 minutes before springing up, suddenly decisive. She took the boxes into the bathroom, lifted their tops, and emptied the contents into the toilet. She watched every ounce, every rock, every leaf, every crystal float to the bottom of the toilet bowl until the water was cloudy and white. She flushed it away once, and then again and again, until the water in the bowl returned to its normal clarity. She put the tops back on the boxes and placed the boxes on Wes's bed. A few hours later, Wes walked into his room and saw the two shoe boxes. His heart plummeted. These were his work boxes. He knew he was busted. He started to think about what he would say to his mother as he slowly walked toward his bed. Maybe he would blame it on someone else. Maybe he could say that he was holding them for a friend and never knew what was in them. Maybe he could say they were planted, that this was part of a larger conspiracy against him. But who would bother conspiring against him? When he reached the boxes and picked them up, he was struck by how light they were. He opened one of them and saw that it was empty. Had she thrown his drugs out? His anxiety about getting caught flipped to anger. He threw the boxes across the room. He tried to calculate how much weight he had lost and how much money he now owed to the connects who supplied him with the drugs. "Damn!" he shouted. "Ma, where are you? Do you know what you just did?"
"I'm in my room," Mary responded.
Wes stepped quickly to his mother's room, gaining anger with every creaky floorboard. When he walked into the room, Mary was calmly folding laundry on her bed. She didn't stop when he busted in. Wes was senseless with anger, but Mary just coolly looked at him, eyes opened in an expression of exaggerated innocence.
"Ma, do you have any idea what you just did? Where are the drugs?"
"I flushed them down the toilet."
"That was over $4,000 of drugs! I have to pay someone back for that!"
Wes had completely forgotten about his conspiracy argument. The only thing on his mind was trying to figure out how on earth he was going to come up with $4,000, and fast. Mary was not the least bit concerned about her son's new dilemma.
"Not only did you lie to me, but you were selling drugs and keeping them in my house, putting all of us in danger because of your stupidity. I don't want to hear your sob story about how much money you owe. You will stop selling that stuff. I will be checking your room, and I don't want to ever see it here again. Now get out of my room!"
Wes was stunned. He went back to his room and desperately tried to devise a plan. He owed money, but had no drugs to sell. He had to figure out how to make that money back quickly. The only way to do that was to go see his connects and hit the streets again. He'd realized very early in the game that the drug market was a simple supply and demand equation. The demand was bottomless. Your money was determined by how hard you worked and how feared you were. He focused. He knew the streets would get him that money back, and more. But next time, he'd be smart about where he kept the stash and how often he moved it around. Wes left the house and began to walk towards his girlfriend's place a few blocks over. She was older, about 17. Wes complained to her about his mother's abuse of his privacy. His girlfriend sympathized. Before she realized what she was doing, she'd agreed to make her home his new headquarters. As Mary heard the door slam behind Wes, she sat back down on her bed. She pressed her fingers against her temples and began to massage them. She closed her eyes. Her mind raced. Who's to blame for this? Tony? The neighborhood? The school system? Wes's friends? She put them all on trial in her mind. She was furious at Wes for what he'd done,
and knew that this probably would not be the end of it. Tony, who was about to become a father, making Mary a 36-year-old grandmother, had been right. Leave the smack and the crack for the whack or the vowel and the nine, keep a smile like that. My eyes were closed, and my hands moved along with the beat, as if I were on stage laying down tracks on a DJ set. I was in a zone, concert mode, even if I was only in the front seat of my mother's blue Honda Civic. I recited a verse from the Chub Rock song as it blared out of the car's speakers. The road lost my mother's full attention momentarily as she stared down at me. She looked incredulous. After a series of unsatisfactory report cards, my mother had begun to think that what many of my teachers were telling her was correct. I might have a learning disability. My teachers broke it down for her more than once. Wes is a nice boy, but he has real problems retaining information. She remembered this as she listened to me reciting lyrics like I'd written them myself. Anyway, the shunless one bring forth the fun, no hatred, the summer's almost done. How long have you known that song? I don't know. Not long. I mumbled out, lazily opening my eyes but never picking my head up to look at my mother. I'd first heard the song 2 days earlier. Well, your grades obviously aren't bad because you can't pick this stuff up or because you're stupid. You're just not working hard enough, my mother said, her voice rising into the epiphany. My academic failures had forced her to go through the stages of grief. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. She'd been stuck in depression for a long time and hadn't quite made it to acceptance, no matter how much I'd hoped she'd get there. It seemed like there was faulty wiring in the system, because now she was reverting to anger. You'd think I'm playing, just try me, she said, the last note in a short conversation she seemed to be having with herself, and then returned her full attention to the road. As she did so, the new EPMD song came on. She must have noticed my slight head nod to the beat, because she quickly killed the radio. Hip-hop had begun to play a special role in my life. It wasn't just music and lyrics. It was a validator. In my struggle to reconcile my two worlds, it was an essential asset. By the late 1980s, hip-hop had graduated from being the underground art of the Bronx to a rising global culture. My obsession with hip-hop kept me credible with my kids in the neighborhood. It let them know that, regardless of my school affiliation, I still understood. Hip-hop also gave the kids in my school a point of entry into my life. Public Enemy's Black Nationalist anthems or KRS-One's pulpy fantasies about gunning down crack dealers offered a window into a world that before hip-hop had seemed foreign to those who even dared to look through. But even more than that, I found in hip-hop the sound of my generation talking to itself, working through fears and anxieties and inchoate dreams of wealth or power or revolution or success we all shared. It broadcast an exaggerated version of our complicated interior lives to the world, made us feel less alone in the madness of the era, less marginal. Of course, all that didn't matter to my mother. All she knew was that I could effortlessly recite hip-hop lyrics while struggling with my English class. What she didn't know was that my problem in school was much more basic than a learning disability. The problem was that I wasn't even showing up half the time. It's tough to do well in school as an 11-year-old when you're picking and choosing which days to go. It was weeks before I had my schedule down pat. I realized the only time anyone really cared about my attendance was during homeroom, the first class of the day. 2 days of the week, I had homeroom with my English teacher, Mrs. Downs, a young blonde who had taught only one other class in her life. I sensed her weakness and spent most of the class trying to come up with creative ways to burnish my status as class clown. One day, she flatly told me it didn't matter to her if I showed up because the class ran smoother when I wasn't there. From that moment, I understood Mrs. Downs and I had an unspoken agreement. A don't ask, don't tell pact that worked like a charm for both of us. Here's how a typical day would go. My grandmother would drop Shawnee and me off at school or at the train stop and we would wave goodbye, book bags in hands and smiles on faces. We would turn around and begin marching towards a school building or train stop until my grandmother's car pulled away. At that point, I'd have to decide how I would play it. Some days, I would check into homeroom. Other days, I'd head directly back to the train and return to the neighborhood, where I'd meet up with one of the guys who had a similar arrangement. My sister, always the loyal accomplice, never snitched. With our mother working so much, and our grandparents obviously slowing in energy, my sisters and I were supposed to look after one another. Nikki was older, so she was always the one looking after me. And it was my responsibility to look after Shawnee. But Nikki's hands were full with her own turbulent high school experience, which was about to come to a close. The move to the Bronx had been hard on her. Nikki never fully adjusted to the new social and academic environment. She attended 3 different high schools in 4 years. Shawnee, by contrast, was a prodigy. She did not go outside much, except to play basketball with me and my friends, and she seemed to have a book with her wherever she went. In fact, by the time I hit 5th grade and she was in 3rd grade, she had overtaken me in reading scores, a distinction she carried through our entire academic lives and probably holds to this day. As much of a screw-up as I was becoming, I still tried hard to look after her. A few months earlier, Shawnee went out to play with one of the neighborhood girls, Letitia, and came back home with her face covered in blood. When I returned home later that day, she was sitting on the couch in the living room, a red-stained napkin stuck in one of her nostrils, and my grandmother's arms wrapped around her shoulders. They told me what had happened. Shawnee, Letitia, and a Puerto Rican girl named Ingrid were jumping rope outside the house. A dispute broke out, words were exchanged, and Shawnee found herself on the receiving end of a punch to the nose. Shawnee was much bigger than the other girl, and was used to wrestling with me, but she didn't fight back. She just started crying and headed into the house, pinching her nose to stop the bleeding. By the end of the story, I was furious. First, at Shawnee for not punching Letitia back, but then at Letitia, who had the audacity to go after my sister. Just recently off my first encounter with the movie The Godfather, I pulled a Sonny Corleone and flew out the door to find Letitia. My actual godmother, who was standing by the door, also wanted in on the action. I'm BB, a tall, light-skinned Alabamian, who had known my grandparents since she moved up to New York 30 years ago, was one of our family's fiercest defenders, and she was not going to let me go out there to avenge my sister without her being there. She had also just moved into the house with us, making it 8 of us in our small row home. Just as fired up as I was, Aunt Bebe followed me up the street. In retrospect, we made a comical pair of enforcers, a 40-something-year-old woman trailing an 11-year-old boy. But we were deadly serious. When we rolled up to her house, Letitia was sitting on the front steps with her older brother. She straightened up with a surprised look. Aunt Bebe demanded to know why she hit Shawnee. Letitia stumbled through an answer, claiming she was defending herself. Aunt Bebe cut her off. Little girl, don't you ever touch her again. I don't know who you think you are, but you are really messing with the wrong one. Letitia stared back. She was too cool to show submission and too scared to show defiance. As we started to walk away, I decided I couldn't let my aunt handle the fight solo, so I turned around to face Letitia while keeping an eye on her older brother. And let me tell you, I said, if I ever hear about you touching her again, the last thing you will have to worry about is a bloody nose. Not only was her brother older and bigger, but he had a rep as one not to be played with. But I just stood there in my b-boy stance, empowered by strains of "The Bridge is Over" running through my head, until I felt like the message had gotten across. Satisfied, Aunt Bebe and I took off for our house. I was a little shaken as we walked back home in the twilight. Little things like this had a way of escalating into blood feuds. Big brothers called bigger brothers, who called crews. But Shawnee never played with Letitia again, and fortunately, I never saw her brother again. The Bronx streets had become a fixture in my life. Whether it was playing ball at Gun Hill Project's basketball court, heading over to Three Boys on Burke Avenue to get a slice of pizza, running to Saul's to get an edge up on Bronxwood, or just sprawling out on stoops with my crew, some of the most important lessons I learned from these streets. I learned about girls getting periods not from biology class, but from my friend Paris. I learned the realities of gang violence not from after-school specials, but when my boy Mark got jumped and beaten down for wearing the wrong color jacket. And I learned that cops were smarter than I thought on the corner of Laconia Avenue. I was rocking my Olaf's basketball shorts and Syracuse t-shirt on an unseasonably warm Saturday in October. I'd always wanted to go to Syracuse like my Uncle Howard and play basketball for the Orangemen. I was to find out later that I wanted them a whole lot more than they wanted me. We just finished playing a game of basketball and were leaving the courts when out of the corner of my eye I saw Shay, one of my friends from the neighborhood. Shay was my age but shorter, with reddish hair and light skin, light enough for a spray of freckles to shine through. I broke off from my friends and walked over to him. We met halfway and greeted each other. I asked him what he was up to, and he said confidently, Nothing. Just finished working. I checked out his gear. Black jeans, a white tank top, and a black backpack. Work. I know exactly what that meant. Shea was a runner, an entry-level position in any drug enterprise. A runner was the one who moved packages for local suppliers who needed to make drop-offs for the street-level dealers but didn't want to carry the weight themselves. Kids like Shea were used because they were less conspicuous and less likely to be stopped by police officers. Shea was making decent money, but ever since he started working, we'd seen less of him. Shea and I sat in front of the Q Lounge, a bar and billiards club whose